This download is the only extract the BBC has of this edition of Desert Island Discs. The presenter was Roy Plumley.
Dave, music plays a very small part in your television shows. You don't give us much clue as to your musical taste. Have you any musical skill? Do you play an instrument?
No, I occasionally play the table. That's about as far as I can get.
Is music important in your life?
Very. I love music. I find it relaxing. I love to listen to music.
Dave, you began life as a journalist.
Well, no, as a child, I think.
As a child journalist, yes.
With a pencil in my hand. Yes, I started. I left school and I went, because my father had been a journalist and my grandmother was a journalist, and I went into the Irish Independent as front clerk or front office clerk with the hopes of eventually getting up to the editorial, and got slightly frustrated and then went off into the provinces and worked on a small provincial newspaper.
Why did the theatre become more important?
It was economics, actually, more than anything else. I came to England hoping that within 6 months I would be the top of the pile in Fleet Street and would have my own byline and would be the great reporter. But the gentleman who sat at the editorial's table didn't quite agree with me, and I was asked to go away again to the provinces, which I did. And in the meantime, I had to support myself, so I went to Butlins. I got a job as Butlin Redcoat for the summer. What they call a host.
Yes.
And, or sports organizer. And from that, I got stuck into a ballroom one night with a lot of campers. And the band had a break, and I was asked to keep them amused while the band had a break. And I told a couple of gags and got a laugh, and got a couple of laughs, actually, if I remember right. And then found myself in the Redcoat show, and eventually little bits began to come to me, and I finished up doing a 5-6 minute spot.
At that time, of course, in the mid-50s, some of the music halls were still functioning.
Yes, they were. I formed a double act with another Redcoat because I think we both found courage in numbers.
Yeah.
And the first professional date I played was in London at what was known as Collins Music Hall. And we did a double act to what we used to call the paper curtain, because as soon as comedians would walk on, people would read the papers.
Yes. They were waiting for the strippers.
They were waiting for the strippers. With great delight, they were waiting for the strippers. So what we were was a total interference.
Yes. Then you continued in the music hall?
Then I continued. We toured. We toured all over the country, and then gradually we decided that we were not really double acts, we were single acts.
Mm.
And we broke out, and it was a gradual thing. I toured with rock shows, and I toured with various people who are now very famous.
Were there bad patches when there wasn't any work at all?
Very bad patches, but I used to get a job doing something else. I worked as a timekeeper, and I worked as a, what they call a rough painter, up rather high, 200 feet up on things.
That is rather high.
I dug holes, not for very long, actually, because I got a job as a labourer in Birmingham, and they were laying a pavement, and I was told to dig my trench from one end and join up with this fellow at the other end, who had a most beautiful straight line. Mine was all over the place, so I was asked to leave.
Where did you get your material from in those early days? Did you write your own?
No, I didn't. I, like most young comedians, I would pinch it or hear a gag and use it, which I think is the only way you can do it.
What was the turning point? What was the first break that you had?
I went to Australia. I worked with Sophie Tucker, and she advised me to go to Australia, and half arranged it. And I went out there for a nightclub season, and while I was there, I did some television shows, and somebody spotted me. And the company, or a television company, offered me a pilot show for a chat show, a talk show, a tonight-type show, which I did, and they offered me a contract for a year, which was very good, because I could never have got the experience on British television.
Yes.
Because it was a live show. It was an hour and a half every week. And it was for a year.
And that gave you the confidence?
It gave me great knowledge regarding television studios and cameras and microphones, and gradually after 2 or 3 weeks I'd never bothered about them. It was their job to spy in on me, yes. Not my job to work to them.
So you had your success in Australian television. What happened when you came back to Britain?
I came back and I was lucky enough to have 2 Sunday nights at London Palladium.
Yes.
In 65, when it was at the height of its viewing power, I suppose. And which probably brought back memories to a few people that I was a comedian and I had been about and I had come back.
Mm-hmm.
And from that, the BBC offered me a series with Val Dunigan as a resident comedian, which was exactly what I needed, because I wasn't just, did you see that comedian, whatever his name was. I was there for 13 weeks, which
yes.
gradually built up. And Val and I, towards the end, started to do kind of odd little bits together.
Yes.
And it was, I would say that would be the break in English television for me.
And then you went into the talk of the town for the first time in London.
I did, yes.
And you played a couple of straight parts in the theatre.
Yes, I did a play for Edna O'Brien at the Royal Court, which was great experience and great fun, because when I'm working, I normally work by myself. So suddenly to have 10 or 12 other people working with you and waiting for their lines to come to you so you can give your lines back to them, was slightly confusing, because there were times I wanted to drift off and make up my own play.
Are you one of the comedians who wants to play Hamlet?
No. No, I don't think so. I admire the play tremendously. I think it's a beautiful play. But I don't have the training for it.
Mm-hmm. You have played in Peter Pan.
I played Captain Hook, yes. And Mr. Darling.
You enjoyed that?
Oh, tremendously. I love fairies, and I love magic, and I love eternal youth, and the hate that the children would radiate from all over I mean, it was literally a physical thing. I mean, they would throw sweets at me. In the final scene of Peter Pan, which is the ship scene, as Captain Hook, when I would strut around with my cigar, smoking it, waiting for the hissing of these children to stop, that was the moment when all that hate would be directed at me, totally alone on the stage. And they would work themselves up into such a frenzy. And I always remember there was one child in the box close to the stage, which was, all the hate. I mean, 5 years of age, and everything that she disliked, I was. And she was glaring at me and sticking her tongue out and screaming and hissing and everything. And I was front middle stage, and I moved 2 paces towards the box, and you have never seen a child disappear so quickly in your life. And after about 10 seconds, these little eyes came over, and that's all I could see after that.
Your TV shows, Dave, you sit on a stool and you tell stories, and you cut away to very short blackout sketches. You don't have any back-slapping guests, and you don't have any dance routines, and you don't overexpose yourself on the box. You do, what, 6 at a time?
6 shows, yes, per year.
In 6 programmes, how many stories, how many sketches?
Well, we normally record, I think, something like 250 sketches.
For each series?
For the whole series, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are sometimes, we have no way of gauging whether the thing is really funny until we plonk it in front of an audience. I mean, we think it's funny.
Yes.
And I think we have possibly a success rate of something like 85-90%.
So the studio audience sees a longer show than eventually goes on the air. You cut away the dross, as it were.
Yes. They would see probably about an hour. Yes. We run it straight at them, generally.
How long does the series take to assemble?
About 5 months. Generally about 3 to 4 weeks, practically, for every show, with writing and recording and filming.
Your religious gags about the Pope and the confessionals and so on. You're an Irishman working in a Protestant country. Doesn't this get your audience laughing at rather than with you?
You might be very right. I have never given that any thought at all. I do know that I am an Irishman. I do know that the Irish people as a whole generally laugh at religion, whether it be theirs or somebody else's.
Yes. Do you get many complaints when one reads the odd piece in the paper about Dave Allen goes over the top again, but...
I get a fair amount, but what I do have is a tremendous amount of friends within the clergy, both Church of England and Roman Catholic, and I hope rabbis and various other people. And I've yet to find, really, the priest who gets angry, or the nun who gets angry.
Mm-hmm.
In general, they can laugh where people think they shouldn't laugh. And they do have senses of humour. And what one is working about is that it becomes an inside gag, and they understand that much more than the layperson. Yeah.